Epilogue. An Ordinary Life. Pierman Watman of Chesborough shut and locked the door of his white stone church as his acolyte led his white gelding horse around from the stable. The pure man had few dark hairs left upon his head, but those he had he let grow so he could flop them over the territory abandoned by their brothers. In his wisdom, he had dressed in his best white robe of office, and even shaved so that he would inspire the reverence that was due him and the respect that was needed to accomplish a delicate task. "Young people," he disparaged as he mounted and set off at a steady pace. "Why Eldoroth had designed the race of man to have the most passion, vitality, and power when least able to use them wisely was a mystery of creation he had yet to settle in his own mind. While not old himself, his back hurt after performing tasks as mundane as fetching water from the well, and his eyes no longer permitted him to study by candlelight for more than half a watch. More subtly, when the young women of the church interacted with him, they treated him with the notice they would give a father, rather than an eligible man, though he castigated himself for even noticing. But age held some advantages besides wisdom. It brought an ability to convey gravity and solemnity, and these abilities he needed today to deal with the young Mr. and Mrs. de Bellamane. When the two first took Greenwood Cottage on Bristlebridge Lane during the winter, and not enough time to move in as it was, they did not seem disposed to much troublemaking and kept to themselves, save for their steady attendance at church each seventh day, for which Pierman Watman was initially satisfied with regards to their moral characters. Soon after their settling in, several parishioners complained that the two had slighted them by refusing invitations to dinners, dances, and other social occasions, besides the apparently unforgivable crime of not hosting any themselves. Pierman Watman agreed that Greenwood Cottage had long been abandoned and needed visitors, and the master and mistress of Greenwood, being so young, would profit from good society. But as winter wore on and eventually thawed, their reclusiveness melted with the snow. They visited, and were visited in turn. They attended every event for which they received invitation, and a few for which they had not, much to the consternation of the hosts. For the last year, the alarming reports of their behaviour had trickled in, and for a year the pure man ignored them. Nothing Mr. and Mrs. de Bellamane did, technically, violated any principle that it was his calling or the magistrate's to address, but the fastidious Mrs. Forsyth, a widow and close neighbour of the de Bellamanes, had at last worn him down with her nagging. As she explained it, the parents or family of the offenders were the ones normally applied to in order to deliver censure and effect restraint in these cases. Since the de Bellamanes hailed from a distant country and had no near relations, Mrs. Forsyth felt the burden of corrective intervention naturally fell to their religious authority. The pure man doubted this logic, but the stalwart widow's droning would only be silenced upon the performance of this task, and as the city proper faded behind him, he felt at peace with what he would do. Perhaps he could inspire some good sense in the de Bellamanes after all. Besides, he had never called on them personally, as he should have done when they first arrived in town, and a closer association with a pure man would also aid them in acquiring a bit more sobriety. Bristlebridge Lane rolled over low hills, lightly peppered with white spruce and a few yellow maples. A wide, shallow stream banked in thorned locust bushes divided two of the taller hills, and the grey stone bridge that bore the lane's namesake carried him over water, ponderous in its movement south. Ducks paddled about with webbed orange feet, as complacent in movement and purpose as the stream that carried them. After the bridge and a turn in the road, a blooming cherry orchard exploded into view, branches cheerful with snowy spring blossoms. A Mr. Fotsam owned the orchard and the title to the cottage the de Bellamanes rented. His sleek hunting hounds bolted out of the orchard, yapped at the horse and bit at its heels until the pure man cleared the last of the trees and headed out into open country again. The lane was well kept. The inhabitants of the pleasant country were nearly all well-to-do and travelled frequently enough to keep encroaching plants from obscuring the road. Mrs. Forsyth was forward enough to complain to the magistrate in the event that the road ever did become too overgrown, too rutted, or in any other way unsatisfactory. He crested another hill and descended the steep slope on the other side. There was the abode of Mrs. Forsyth, Farrow Cottage, and the de Bellamanes' residence, Greenwood Cottage. The lane separated them, though their front doors were no more than 50 yards from one another. "Part of the problem," he concluded. The theme of Farrow Cottage was grass and field, while Greenwood's was tree and garden. The structures, however, were of similar design, two-story affairs of a light grey stone with two high arched windows on either side of the door in the front. While the walls of Farrow Cottage were scoured and clean, vines had spidered over the front of the other, water dripping from the slate roof discolouring the stone. He pulled the reins and guided the horse down the short cobblestone drive that circled a garden wild with untamed flowers and fecund plants. Towering spruce lined the lane and sheltered the house beneath their thick boughs, as if protecting and warming a treasured egg. Woodland debris littered the modest lawn that surrounded the cottage, which brought to mind one of Mrs. Forsyth's complaints. Peculiarly, the de Bellamains employed no servants or gardeners, and as a result the upkeep of the grounds wanted attention. No doubt the interior suffered in a similar fashion. Tying his horse to a post near the circular flowerbed, he started toward the door, when sounds from within the house caught his attention, stopping his foot on the first stair. An irregular clacking sound was punctuated by the vigorous voices of a man and a woman. The pure man ascended, thinking perhaps the young couple engaged in some altercation, but as he neared the door, face lined with worry, he could hear their conversation more clearly, and relaxed.
"I think I've taught you better than that, Merta. Maybe I'll need to tie both arms behind my back next time."
"Oh, really, Lord de Bellamain?" The clacking resumed, along with the sound of furniture being violently pushed aside, a dull thwack.
"Ow!" Merta cried out. "And maybe I'll tie a sackful of potatoes to my legs as well. Impertinent dog!"
It occurred to Watman that they were engaged in sword play with one another. Mrs. Forsyth had not invented that little detail.
"What decent man would teach his wife the blade, and what decent woman would submit to the instruction?" he wondered, realizing now his task was more mountain than molehill. A vase crashed to the ground, shards tinkling about the floor.
"That vase was expensive," Merta complained.
"Oh, really? Was this one?"
Another crash.
"I actually liked that one."
"I apologize, dear. You really should avoid coming toe-to-toe with someone stronger than you. In this position, he could have his way with you."
"Hmm," Merta cooed. "And do what?"
The pier man remembered to knock at this point. Another whack.
"Ow!"
yelped Mr. de Bellamain.
"That was uncalled for. Most dishonourable, not to mention cowardly."
"Don't be a baby. We have a visitor," Merta said cheerfully. "Put the furniture in order, and I'll see who it is."
The door opened, and the pure man laid eyes on Merta de Bellamain. He had seen her before, a lovely blonde woman, buxom, thin-waisted, and with eyes blue enough to sink in. But he had never seen her attired in such a fashion. She was barefoot, wearing tight leather breeches and a light sleeveless shirt that emphasized every pleasing curve. She held an air of confidence and command that unnerved him. The pure man coloured a little as she leaned the wooden practice sword against the doorframe and smiled at him.
"Oh, Frederick, dear, it is the pure man come at last to pay us a visit. Do come in, pure man Watman. We are most happy to receive you."
"I am much obliged, Mrs. de Bellamain."
The pure man walked into the sitting room, scanning the floor to avoid pieces of the vase he might step on. Mr. de Bellamain put the couches and chairs back in their proper order, on top of a series of muted grey and blue rugs patterned to resemble a clouded sky. The room filled with light from the high windows, and the pure man thought it very cheerful. Mr. de Bellamain had his shirt off, his lean, shockingly muscular torso sliding the chairs, couches, and tables about with little exertion. The furniture itself was plain but comfortable, and Mrs. de Bellamain motioned for the pure man to sit in a padded chair near the fireplace where banked embers glowed. She sat opposite him, but as Mr. de Bellamain crossed to join her on the couch, she held him up.
"Dear, I believe you should put a shirt on for the pure man," she suggested.
"And you should put on a dress," the pure man added mentally. "Shameless."
Mr. de Bellamain disappeared into the rear of the house, while the pure man collected his thoughts in spite of the distracting scrutiny of Merta de Bellamain. She smiled at him.
"We had quite despaired of receiving a visit from you, pure man Watman. I do hope we are not such troublesome parishioners as to cause you discomfort. I know how unpleasant tasks are often delayed as long as possible. I would hate for us to be one of those."
"I do apologize, Mrs. de Bellamain," the pure man said. "I am tardy in my attentions to you and your husband. I can offer no excuse. I am typically very preoccupied during the winter months,
with caring for the sick and afflicted, but this year Chesborough has been blessed with uncommon good health. I've hardly had occasion to leave the church at all. Have you and Mr. de Bellemaine enjoyed good health the past months?
Indeed we have.
Mr. de Bellemaine entered the room, still working at the top buttons of a high-collared white shirt. The pure man was gratified to see he had the decorum to wear a coat as well. The pure man stood as the master of the house crossed to him and shook hands with him, noticing a bruised lump sprouting on the top of the young man's hand, no doubt received from their earlier sword play. They both returned to their seats. Mrs. de Bellemaine smiled affectionately at her husband, snuggling up next to him as he sat and placing her hand on his thigh. The pure man fought to keep his countenance, but in that instant the whole of their life history unfolded before him.
Frederick de Bellemaine, he speculated, is probably the second or third son of some minor lord in the south, for surely the family would not let the oldest son mingle with such a woman. He was probably destined for the church when he met up with this coquettish tart of a lady. Since he was a lesser son, the parents likely thought nothing of their being together until he forsook his family obligations and eloped. She probably had already fled some prior indiscretion before throwing herself at Mr. de Bellemaine.
But as they exchanged more pleasantries about the country and the weather, he noted that whatever their ill judgments in the past, these two genuinely cared for each other. The complete ease and playfulness with which they engaged one another, the pleasure radiating from their eyes and faces, and the way each one's words would complement, amplify, and weave in with the others, even in interruption or amendment, struck the pure man. Here was no stiffness or awkwardness, no conversation where the spouse's words and thoughts knocked together like strangers in the dark, no unnatural concealment of affection or regard. What they felt, they demonstrated plainly and without device. Pure Man Whatman recalculated. These two had known each other for some time, most likely since childhood. Long familiarity eroded those barriers and mores that normally accompanied an engagement and persisted into the marriage state afterward.
They are definitely from the country, he concluded. They have not had much experience in society to witness proper examples or to endure the kind of scrutiny that would mould their behaviour appropriately. It will be difficult to change them. One should straighten the tree while it is a sapling.
So, pure man, Mrs. de Bellemaine began after a lull, you mentioned that good health has blessed us. Are there no cases of sickness, even now?
There is, unfortunately, one situation that is outside the normal run of headaches, nerves and coughs common in all seasons. The Barnes, a poor family that live on the downs, have a young girl, Alna, afflicted with the pig fever. She is a dear girl of only 6 years, a voice as pleasant an instrument as ever tuned by Eldaloth's hand. I've just received word and will attend to her this evening. She is a bit young to overcome the sickness, I fear, not to mention that her family's situation isn't such that encourages health or recovery. I have little hope of her improvement.
He noted the concern in Mrs. de Bellemaine's eyes.
That is unfortunate, she said.
We should visit them this afternoon, her husband commented, face grave.
Yes, she continued, and see what we can do to support them. Do you think they could use a blanket for the child?
I believe so, Mr. de Bellemaine answered thoughtfully. Wholesome food would certainly be in order.
They do scrape by down there, Merta said. I wonder if they are cleaning as they should.
The pure man jumped in before they could continue.
I think it best if you leave it to the ministrations of the church. We will know how to succour them. It would be dangerous and inappropriate for you to go there. It is a filthy place.
Why, pure man, she remonstrated, we shall hardly be deterred by a little dirt.
As for the danger, surely you noted that we have some skill with weaponry. We have metal swords to go with the wooden ones. Would you like to see them?
No, he declined. But may I ask, do you fence with each other often?
When we get the chance of it, Mr. de Bellemaine answered. I like to keep my skills sharp, so I've asked her to ambush me about the house unexpectedly.
Pure Man Whatman frowned.
I'm sure we could find other young men in the country who would be happy to spar with you.
No doubt they would be happy, until they sparred with me, he stated matter-of-factly.
His wife laughed.
Oh, Frederick, you mustn't be so cocky. I'm sure the pure man could arrange for some eligible opponents, though they may object to being smacked on the bottom as you do to me. I would love to watch a match. It's been so long since I've seen you humiliate someone.
The pure man couldn't believe the forwardness of the woman.
Yes, Yes, young Darby Mills is quite handy with a blade, as is the sheriff. Either one could provide you ample sport, without you needing to put upon your wife for such an office.
I am not put upon, dear Pure Man, she objected. I quite enjoy the instruction. I was actually thinking of asking the other ladies about town if they should wish to learn.
The Pure Man snapped his jaw up.
Where did these people come from? I assure you, Mrs. de Bellarmine, that such invitations would be universally despised and rejected. But the disclosure of your plan allows me to address now the object of my visit. I do not know your history or the land of your upbringing, but several of my parishioners have commented on how your manners are quite different from what is typical of the people in this area of the country.
Oh, really? Mr. de Bellarmine said, though the Pure Man failed to detect much gravity in his face. Hers was a mask of saucy amusement.
I do hope we have not caused overmuch offence. We have enjoyed the neighbourhood, though Mrs. Forsyth does seem a bit rigorous in her vigil of our house.
Do be clear, dearest, Mrs. de Bellarmine put in. This is a Pure Man, and we shan't beat about the bush. What you mean to say was that Mrs. Forsyth is an insufferable spy.
The Pure Man coughed.
I assure you that she is an honourable, though observant, woman.
Mrs. de Bellarmine laughed again.
Observant? Very good, Pure Man, very good. It's like saying Ogmir and Tolnor were merely uncomfortable with one another, and that Mikik suffered from a bit of distemper.
Mr. de Bellarmine grinned widely at his wife's quip.
I am losing control of this conversation, the Pure Man fretted.
He cleared his throat loudly. He really had no idea how he would divulge the long list of complaints levelled against them, so he just ploughed into them, in the kindest way he could imagine.
Mr. and Mrs. de Bellarmine, I urge you to hear me with all seriousness. In this part of the country, there are some matters of decorum that must be heeded if you are to endear yourself to the community here. We believe women are too delicate for the coarse nature of handling weaponry. While it behooves every man of substance to learn the art of war for the defence of his honour, his home, and his country, the female sex should pursue those occupations for which kind hearts and gentle hands are best suited. Then there is the matter of staying out of doors until all hours of the night. Genteel people should keep respectable hours, save for the direst of emergencies. What good could come of wandering the dark, or what good could those who witness such wandering think of those who wander? The dark hours are for the idle, and those of disrepute. It would be a danger to the person and the honour of anyone to be about during the late watches.
Jen perked up.
But, Pure Man, isn't this a bit like children accusing their siblings of opening their eyes during the oblation, when they themselves would have had to open their own eyes to witness the infraction? Or did the idle and disreputable tell you this of us?
It is Mrs. Forsyth, Mrs. de Bellarmine conjectured. Watching us is her chief form of entertainment. Since she stays indoors to do it, she can stay up late without tarnishing her reputation. I guess that makes her idle, but not disreputable.
Please, I do not mean to offend, the Pure Man soothed. Mrs. Forsyth,
but Pure Man Watman, Mrs. de Bellarmine interjected. Haven't you seen the stars at that time of a clear winter night? When the glow in the west has dissolved into utter blackness, and every lamp in the city is extinguished? They shine and twinkle like a room full of the eyes of the happiest children ever to breathe a blessing on the world. If those who view this habit as amiss would just sit up late, walk into a midnight field and look up, then their censure for us would turn into a sympathetic joy. Have you seen them, Pure Man?
The Pure Man was taken aback by her sincere passion.
Of course. I am about late on many errands to the sick, he answered,
though he admitted to himself that he never had quite taken notice of the sky. He changed the subject quickly.
But in addition to this, you win too much at cards, often arrive at functions to which you were not invited, and insist on keeping no servants, which places you in the position of doing low work, when you should instead be about the improvement of your minds and attending to some social obligations that are your duty to perform. But lastly, and perhaps most seriously, it has been noted by several of the people in this domain that you two are frequently, and in public places, guilty of that sort of affectionate contact which discomforts those who may, perchance, view it. Such activities are for the discreet confines of your own walls, here, in private. Wouldn't you agree?
Mrs. de Bellemaine smiled oddly. Frederick, I do believe the pure man is desperately trying to convince us to stay indoors a great deal more, despite the warming weather. I don't think we've ever been that demonstrative, have we, Frederick?
Dearest, Mr. de Bellemaine said, remember that time at Mrs. Chisholm's, on All Peace Day?
The wine cellar? Oh, I had forgotten about that. Why would Mrs. Forsyth ever come down to a wine cellar? Seems it would be beneath her dignity. And now that the subject is broached, I do recall the balcony at Mr. Lord's ball, though I would hardly think Mr. Havleton could be that shocked that two newlyweds would be kissing in the moonlight. Surely he isn't that stodgy at his age.
You are mistaken, Murta, Mr. de Bellemaine corrected. Miss Green found us at the ball. Remember her shriek? Mr. Havleton stumbled upon us in the thicket at Winter Park.
Yes, that's right. Was that ever cold, especially when the snow shook off the branches and... Well, what business did Mr. Havleton have in that particular thicket at that time of day anyway? I'm sure I don't want to know, and thus spoil the memory.
Mr. de Bellemaine turned back to the pure man.
You have a point, though in our defence, I would argue that the problem isn't that we aren't discreet. We just aren't very good at it.
Please continue.
The pure man, however, was done, vaguely mumbling that he was finished and hoped they hadn't taken offence, though he doubted they were capable of taking any in the first place. There was some hope for Mr. de Bellemaine, though the wife was clearly beyond amendment. The pure man decided he would need to talk to Frederick alone. Perhaps by inspiring him to more judicious behaviour, he might exercise some control over his spouse. Of course, Elderloth was patient, and a few years might invest them both with a bit more sobriety. A devastating trial might do them good as well. The sound of a horse and cart entering the drive cut short the pure man's announcement that he was leaving.
"Is it Davis?" Mr. de Bellemaine asked of his wife, who had crossed to the window.
"Yes, good, we'll have him ready the horses. My thought exactly. I'll find a blanket for Alna."
The pure man furrowed his eyebrows.
"Davis Corbett?"
"The very one," Mr. de Bellemaine confirmed.
"What have you to do with the lad?" the pure man asked, intrigued. "Have you hired him for some purpose?"
He could think of few things worse than exposing impressionable children to people such as these. Davis was but 10 years of age. His mother was a widow seamstress, quite poor, her son a bandy-legged, sickly wretch, whose disability prevented him from being much service to his mother or anyone else besides. The pure man reminded himself to pay Mrs. Corbett a visit, as he hadn't seen her since Harvest Festival.
"He performs some work for us around the house," Mr. de Bellemaine explained. "In exchange, Murta teaches him letters, and I'm teaching him the care of horses and how to shoot a bow." "Is everyone to learn weaponry?" the pure man grumped to himself. "Next he'll be teaching me to swing a club and Mrs. Forsyth to knife fight."
Mrs. de Bellemaine crossed to the door and opened it before Davis could knock.
"Good morning,"
she greeted him brightly, embracing her freckled, sandy blonde student, who received it gratefully and familiarly. The pure man turned and his mouth dropped open. When last he saw the lad, it was a walking horseshoe, legs so severely bent he couldn't manage steps or walk at more than a turtle's pace. His face had been ashen, his eyes dim, and his manner so languid that he scarce could be placed in the category of the living. While there could be no doubt this was the same boy, the alteration in him was severe. Legs as straight as broomsticks supported a frame full of vitality. The pure man stood and greeted the boy, amazed at the clarity in the brown eyes and the energy that beamed from a perfectly sanguine face.
"But, Davis," the pure man exclaimed, "you are so much improved since I last saw you, I can scarce believe it. What a blessing is yours. How have you come into such health?"
As with most youth his age, he shrugged his shoulders and looked to the floor.
"I don't know. Just got better, I suppose." "Elderloth has indeed favoured you. I am gratified."
Mr. and Mrs. de Bellemaine looked at the boy with a great deal of pride and satisfaction, Mr. de Bellemaine wrapping his arm affectionately around his wife's slender waist. The pure man shook his head and took his leave, resolving to visit the widow Corbett immediately to inquire further into the matter of her young Davis. Surely there was some miracle there he could use to inspire his congregation. He untied his horse and mounted, noticing Mrs. Forsyth watching him expectantly from her front porch across the way as he rode out to the lane. No doubt she wished to speak to him, but he would defer that conversation until later. If the de Bellamains were to notice him with her directly after visiting them, it would seem as if he were reporting to her and thus confirm that she was indeed the instigator of his visit. The warming air and steady canter of the horse relaxed him after what he could only label an ordeal of a visit. But while at first his recollection of his visit to the de Bellamains only brought worry and irritation, as he rode by the spring fields and orchards burgeoning with life, his mind drifted on another tack. Satisfaction with his calling and his life had always accompanied him through the years, but amid the buzzing of insects, the blossom of the trees, and flood of sunshine, his heart felt sensible of some loss he couldn't quite grasp. He tried to dispel these thoughts and feelings, but they persisted through his arrival in town and his half-hearted greetings to the men and women crowding the streets as he rode. As he turned toward the widow's house, the passionate words of Mrs. de Bellamain sank into his heart. He sighed and smiled, making a quick resolution.
"Tonight I will study late, walk into Farmer Justin's pasture, and look up."
You have been listening to Sacrifice, Book 4 of the Trismoon Saga, produced by Greg Lawrence. Executive producers James Tonn and Greg Lawrence. Text copyright 2014 by Brian K. Fuller. Production copyright 2015 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved.